Good morning. Welcome to GreensList, our final CPD briefing for the year. Obviously, being the March, the end of the CPD year. I hope you've got all your points. Hopefully, this is the last one you need. This morning, we've got Peter Lovell and Ray Delarue to talk to us about costs. Peter is probably, if not one of the top two or three cost experts at the bar, probably does more appearances than most other barristers in the cost court. He's been at the bar since 1980. Admitted since 81. Peter, not at the bar. Joined the bar in 96. We'll leave questions to the end if that's possible. We'll leave 10 to 15 minutes towards the end. So, if you've got some questions there, if we can hold them to then. If I could ask Peter Lovell.
Thanks, Brett. Welcome all. You have a paper which I've produced that I normally speak to for approximately 1 hour, but limited to half an hour. I'll take you through it fairly quickly, which may be pleasing to some. You'll see there that the overview refers to or indicates that we're going to be fleetingly discussing legislation, rules, cost disclosure, cost agreements, cost assessments, etc. And I've highlighted there the relevant cost legislation. You really, from a practical point of view, only need to look at the Legal Profession Act 2004. The old Act still can apply, but in the year 2013, it's becoming extremely remote. The relevant rules are the Supreme Court rules, Order 63. You might find some scant rules elsewhere, but for all practical purposes, you only need to look at Order 63. And, the appropriate costs scales, which for all intents and purposes would be the Supreme Court, County Court, Magistrate Court scales, but of course there are family court scales and so on. Locating the key concepts in the Legal Profession Act, you see that I've listed some aspects there of Part 3.4. Now, this, in case you don't know what it looks like, is the Legal Profession Act 2004. I know most of you would have two copies of this, one in your office and one at home. But if you don't, I suggest you buy one, because there's a lot of stuff in there that will help you retain fingers that would otherwise be chopped off in the cost court when you breach unwittingly provisions of the Act and or you fail to make appropriate cost disclosure. The application of Part 3.4, in case you don't know, applies pretty much as soon as the client sits down in the chair opposite you at your desk, and you then have to start giving appropriate costs, estimates and cost disclosure, and if you choose to, enter into a cost agreement. You'll see a chart there in the paper which sets out what might appear to be some obvious differences between cost disclosure requirements and cost agreement requirements. Of course, whether you enter into a cost agreement's up to you. You don't have to enter into a cost agreement. That's a matter for you. But if you wish to charge your rather low fee of $880 an hour plus GST, then it might be appropriate for you to enter into a cost agreement rather than rely on the scale rates, although, in my opinion, the scale rates are fairly generous within reason, but Ray can speak to that. He knows more about scales than I ever will. With cost disclosure, you should appreciate that cost disclosure and cost estimates is mandatory. You do not have a choice. You have to give cost disclosure. Do not come complaining to anybody saying, gee, it's hard. Politicians don't like lawyers, etc., etc. You have to comply with 3.4.9, that's section 3.4.9 of the cost disclosure provisions. Just very briefly, on that section, it sets out only about 20 things you have to disclose. There are other sections that also require disclosure, But 3.4.9 is a good starting point. A lot of you may have standard cost disclosure statements on your word processing system. And I think it would be prudent if you just cast your eye over them when you get a chance, you know, say Easter Saturday, it'd be nice to just look at the different aspects to see whether that standard document that you probably have been using since 2007 actually applies in 2013. For instance, one of the things you have to disclose is the rate of interest. This is if you wish to charge interest for late payment. I cannot tell you how many times I see cost disclosure statements and cost agreements referring to the Penalty Interest Rate Act. That is the wrong rate of interest. It is causing the cost judge to becoming more grumpy every time I see him. I like to see a smile on his face, so if you would rather use the cash target rate of the Reserve Bank of Australia, or the cash rate target of the Reserve Bank of Australia plus 2%, that's exactly what the legal profession regulations tells you you can use. The other thing that you are obliged to disclose is the avenues that are open to clients to complain about your costs. Many of you may appreciate that we're one of the few professions where when we send a bill, we have a little invitation endorsed on the bill saying, please complain. Now, one of the things that the clients may complain about is are your costs, among other things. And I often see references in the cost disclosure statement about the client having 60 days to complain for a cost review under Division 7. Now, I know time flies, but since 2007, that's been 12 months. The error that is occasionally repeated in the relevant documents is causing great concern in the cost court, so much so that one of the judicial officers is now viewing that as misleading and deceptive conduct. It is not just an error. So please review your cost disclosure statements to make sure that any cost review time limit referred to under Division 7 is 12 months, not 60 days. In case there's any confusion about the 60 days and you've looked at the wrong section, there is a 60-day reference insofar as clients can knock on two doors if they wish to complain about costs. One is they can knock on your door and they can say, please give me an itemised bill of costs. That has to be done within 60 days. That's where I think a lot of people get confused. And if you don't give the client an itemised bill within 60 days, you can't sue for your costs. So don't waste time issuing proceedings in the Magistrates Court or the County Court to sue for costs when you have no basis for doing so. But a different section in the Legal Profession Act goes on to say that if the client knocks on your door too late, or in fact doesn't knock on your door at all, then the client can knock on a second door, and that's the door of the cost court. And if the client chooses to knock on the cost court door, then the client has to do that within 12 months. And that is the particular period of time that's referred to in Division 7, which is part of your disclosure obligations. And even if the client's late in knocking on the cost court door within 12 months, there's still an opportunity, although they've got to run across the road before a Supreme Court judge, there's still an opportunity to even have that period of time extended. So the threat of cost review is never really going to go away. Hence, if you make appropriate cost disclosure, as you're obliged to do, a lot of these problems shouldn't arise. I won't take you through all the points in the chart. I think a lot of it's fairly self-explanatory. But it's worthwhile noting that if you do fail to comply with cost disclosure, one of the downsides of that, if the other side are on the ball, is that your cost agreement, even if valid, can be shot down. So even if you have a valid cost agreement, few of which I see, by the way, but assuming your cost agreement is actually a good one and it is otherwise valid, if you fail to make appropriate cost disclosure, then your cost agreement can be set aside at VCAT. It's one of the powers of VCAT. Your former client can make an application of VCAT to have it set aside. On that basis alone, there are many other bases, but on that basis alone, you can kiss goodbye to your cost agreement. I might say that when you do enter into a cost agreement, if you choose to do so, try and get the name of the Act right. It's actually, I don't know if you realise, but it's in big letters here. I've seen the Legal Provision Act, I've seen the Legal Practice Act 2004, I've seen the Legal Costs Act 2004. I'm not sure who drafts some of these documents that come floating by the Cost Court, but just sort of, I know I'm being facetious, but try and get it right. Okay. Disclosure estimates, I'm leaping through this because of time. Disclosure estimates, it is difficult to give estimates of costs. It's the Cost Court recognises that, thankfully, but they won't forgive you if you don't. So I find it's probably easier to give estimates of costs in phases rather than try and estimate what the total cost is going to be by the year 2020. So try and apply a bit of common sense and maybe break it up into phases of matters and that type of thing. You have to give disclosure when you are settling litigious matters. For instance, at mediation, it's assuming the matter's settled at 9 o'clock at night and you finally have got a smile on your face and you want to get home and everyone's signing the relevant terms of settlement. You need to let the client know what the client's going to get in his or her hip pocket as a result of the settlement, including all the costs that they may have paid on the way by way of interim accounts or may be liable for on a no-win, no-fee basis or whatever. So you have to make sure that that is considered. Briefing counsel, as you know, we as counsel have to also give disclosure, fee disclosure. It's a lot easier for counsel to give fee disclosure because we're giving it from one legal practitioner to another. So our obligations to give disclosure are a lot less. We have to obviously disclose our fees, our fee rates, our estimated total fees, and how often we're going to bill, and that's pretty much about it. Because you are obliged to pass on our disclosure that we give to you so you can pass it on to the client. If, as I understand, some barristers don't do that, well, that's your bad luck. You have to follow it up. And if you don't pass that on, the Cost Court will have you in the gun as well as someone like me. So don't think that you can just shift the blame and say, oh, counsel didn't tell me. You have an obligation to find out from counsel, and insofar as you are instructing solicitors, it may come as a bit of a surprise, but you're supposed to be controlling us up to a point. That certainly was the view of the former taxing master of the Supreme Court. Solicitors control counsel, not the other way around. Okay. If there is a cost dispute which is initiated, the client can complain to the LSC. I haven't spent too much time in this paper on complaints generally. I've really kept it to cost issues or cost disputes. Complaints at the moment can be made by a client to the Legal Services Commissioner as long as those costs are $25,000 or less. I've heard on the grapevine that that's going to go up. I think, in June of this year. I'm not quite sure what it's going up to. It could be $75,000 or $100,000, but don't quote me on that. And clients tend to finish up going to the Legal Services Commissioner. I'm not quite sure why. They must ring up the Law Institute, and the Law Institute puts down a pathway, and clients often get a lot off their chest and write 30-page letters with a lot of underlining, complaining about your costs. But at the end of the day, the Legal Services Commissioner can really only try and mediate the matter. That's nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. But if the matter can't be resolved, then the Legal Services Commissioner will issue a certificate to you and your former client saying we couldn't resolve it, which is really handy, because then you can use that certificate to go to VCAT and you can have a cost brawl at VCAT, because that's where the Act tells you you have to go. The problem with that, in my opinion, this is my personal opinion, the problem with that is you can't go to the cost court once you're on the VCAT path. Why not? Because the Act says you can't. So I find it better to jump the gun and go to the cost court, take the client to the cost court rather than have the client take you to VCAT. There's nothing wrong with VCAT, except if you have a de facto taxation in VCAT, you're doing it via the witness box, because it's like a bit like a court setup, as you probably know. So you will be justifying your costs by producing your file in support of your bill. So you'll have three or four boxes of files around your feet while you're standing in the witness box being cross-examined on what your diary note says or doesn't say, etc., etc. I think it's a little bit more user-friendly to be in the cost court, where you can do it sitting down in an air-conditioned room with nice lighting, and you've got the bar table for yourself, and you can spread your files out on the table, and it's conducted in a more user-friendly manner, and you're not being cross-examined, generally speaking. Okay. Costs that I'm sort of moving fairly rapidly forward to, say, taxations of costs. Taxations of costs are usually between the parties, i.e. losing party paying winning party's costs, or they are your own fees, your own solicitor client costs being taxed where you are trying to recover costs from a client and the client's challenging, for example, the quantum of those costs. That is invariably done in the cost court. It doesn't matter who institutes the cost court proceeding, but the key to the cost court door is called a summons for taxation. It's a pretty straightforward standard document. It's in the Supreme Court rules. And you or your former client will, and I'll speak about solicitor client costs so we don't get confused, you or your former client will issue a summons for taxation. It's a brand new proceeding. It's got nothing to do as such with any prior substantive proceeding. It gets its own proceeding number and so on and so forth. And you will get a date to appear at the cost court, which generally speaking happens to be coincidentally a Tuesday, not always, but a Tuesday. So if it's a Tuesday at 9:30, do not roll up at the cost court with your courier van and seven boxes of files, because it's really only a callover. They will then they'll make orders that the other side can object to your bill, etc., etc., and the matter will be listed for taxation at some future time, usually within 1 or 2 or 3 months, depending on how long your bill is. But once that's on the go, and let's say you're the one that's provided the itemised bill of costs, of your own costs, solicitor client costs, that are going to be taxed, then your former client can object to that. And the way your former client should object to it is not to write a 30-page letter with lots of underlining, but to actually have a notice of objections, which is fairly succinct, and will go through each item that the person wants to object to, because your itemised bill might have 300 items in it. And so the notice of objections will say item 3 excessive, item 7 produce, etc., etc. And that will be the guiding light of how the taxation takes place when you are at the cost court. So you need to rock up then with your 9 boxes of files and go through those items that have been objected to one by one by one for about 3 or 4 days, depending on how long the bill is. And that's really great fun. And of course, you're not in the office earning a quid anyway. At the end of that taxation process, the bill generally will be taxed and allowed at X dollars. And if you're unhappy with that result, or even if your former client's unhappy with that result, there are provisions in the rules to allow what is known as a reconsideration. A cost registrar cannot reconsider, but other than that, for instance, if you were before the costs judge or the judicial registrar, they have an opportunity under the rules to have a second bite at the cherry and reconsider their own order that you or the other person is objecting to. But if after that process, after the reconsideration process, either you or the other side are still unhappy, then the matter can be reviewed and it goes to the next person up the ladder, so to speak, even to the point of going across the road to a Supreme Court judge. Now, it is fairly obvious that the success of what you recover in your bill depends on your file, because it is from your file that the bill has been drawn. And people such as Ray, cost consultants, who draw bills of costs, can give you anecdote after anecdote about the condition of some firm's files and what is or isn't or ought or ought not be in the file. Because if, for example, at a taxation there's a claim in your bill for a 3-hour conference, and it's been objected to by the other side. What will invariably happen is the cost judge will say, produce the diary note, or read me the diary note. At that stage, I usually have shivers going up my spine because my eyes are looking out for the swear words. I might be faced with a diary note that's got drawings of clouds or a little puppy dog in the corner. There might be some bullet points which have sort of odd words that don't seem to refer to anything in particular. Paragraph 17, full stop. And then the cost judge might say, well, show me the diary note. So we produce your diary note to the court bench, where there's a bit of huffing and puffing going on, and invariably that 3 or 4 hour conference will be taxed off or reduced to half an hour or whatever. That diary note, for example, may have no starting time. In fact, they almost never have starting times. They almost never have finishing times. You're lucky if you get some initials as to who was there. So it's up to you to keep good diary notes, because you're the one, I assume, that want to be paid for the work you do. If you want to do something for nothing, just stay at home and watch television for nothing. Don't do a whole lot of work for nothing, because you're not going to be paid. As simple as that. So there are 1,000 other anecdotes I could give you about that sort of thing, but I won't. So just be careful and thorough. The costs of the taxation, generally speaking, and Ray can explain a bit more of this later, but generally speaking, they're built into the end of the bill, at least a solicitor-client bill or a party-party bill. And the current going rate at the moment, if you do receive the cost of the taxation, depending on the underlying work that you've done, for instance, if it's in relation to a magistrate's court proceeding or a Supreme Court proceeding, you'll generally get about $350 to $450 per hour while you're in the cost court during the actual taxation. So if a matter goes for 3 days, that's say 18 hours in total. If you get the cost of the taxation, it'll be 18 times 350 or 450, something like that. So, but if you have conducted yourself poorly, or you do not get an order for the cost of the actual taxation, you'll be paying that amount to the other side. You won't get it. So it's important that your bill is tightly drawn, very well supported by your own file, and then you also reap the rewards of obtaining the cost of the taxation. Finally, when you get your order, and I'm at the end of my paper now, when you get your order, it's enforceable in the usual manner. Whether it's a bill for party-party costs where you get the order for your winning client against a losing client, losing party, or whether it's you as a solicitor getting an order against your former client, those orders can be enforced in the usual way. So, as I've said there in my recommendation, for costing and cost assessment purposes, a well-ordered, thorough file, diligently maintained, will reward your practice more than you might imagine. The alternative is to work unrewarded because of lack of file maintenance. Now, I'm not going to take any questions now. They're going to be at the end when Ray's completed his talk, and he will be speaking on some of the important changes to the costs rules. Thank you.